Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 213 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and her diet. There's a big that goes along with that. Yeah, I knew I'd get your attention. We've got a great show coming up. But before we begin, just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. All right, now here's your first official reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review our show. I sit around waiting to hear from you. And thanks to everyone who's been so wonderful with your feedback, because we just love to hear from you. So, okay, that's your first official reminder. You're going to have another one after the show. So, come on, come on. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
So, I read a review of a book a little while back, and it was called Diet and the Disease of Civilization. Okay, you got my attention. What the heck is that about? And we're going to be having an amazing conversation about looking at, for all intents and purposes, the history of diet. Yeah, you thought it happened yesterday. Wrong. This has been going on for a heck of a long time, and it's got quite the little history. And who better to do it than Adrienne Bitar? She is a PhD, postdoctoral associate in the history department at Cornell University, and she specializes in the history and culture of American food. Well, that's a short one, you know. Cheez-Its and, you know, all the rest of it. Just kidding. I was being mean. In 2018, she did publish Diet and the Disease of Civilization, a cultural and historical analysis of diet books. Yeah, diet books. Oh, yeah, I know. Look up in your shelves now. Yeah, just piled and falling off the shelves with diet books. She's going to help us understand what this all means. Dr. Bitar, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thank you so much, Dr. Peek, for having me.
All right. Now, here we go. We have, first of all, what got you into this in the first place? Because I personally, as an expert in nutrition, found this to be fascinating stuff that I really haven't seen much of anything written about, especially when it comes to diet books. What got you going into this whole thing?
I was first drawn to the topic just by the sheer numbers. It astounded me that, you know, during my graduate training, that there was this whole corpus of books that were massively popular and also enormously influential on the lives of everyday people. 45 million Americans diet every year. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. And these popular diet books sell tens of millions of copies. You know, South Beach, 10 million. Eat Right for Your Type, 7 million. Atkins, 20 million. But in the scholarship and also just in public discourse, these books were sort of dismissed as either meaningless or ineffective, sort of repetitive and formulaic. They weren't taken as seriously as I felt they needed to be. And I wanted to respect both the books themselves as literature, but also the millions of Americans who put their faith in these books and have for the last 100 years.
You know, that's a really interesting point because, you know, I'm an academician and the books I tend to write, are kind of a mix, a curious blend. I have a lot of great research. I always use research, but I also do it in consumer speak, and I do it in a way that I hope sort of enlightens people. But, you know, I've always been thinking to myself, gosh, you know, there are so many books out there that, you know, certainly people like myself and yourself who are more academically inclined, you know, kind of blow off some of these books like rubbish and, you know, really not to be taken seriously. But you said something that really struck me, and that is they affect a lot of people's lives, millions and millions of lives. So, wow, that's just huge. So when you wrote the book, you did a nice historical perspective, and you were kind of looking at, you know, the general chronology of how this all worked. Give us a snapshot of that historical analysis. Like, how far back did you go, for crying out loud?
Pretty far back. I mean, this is a nutrition advice has a long and varied history. I mean, you could go back all the way to, you know, early religious texts. But where, just as you mentioned, Dr. Peek, where the books really became so popular, they were affecting hundreds of thousands of lives, that these are books that are a lot like scripts. People act them out in their everyday life. Most people would turn to William Banting's 1860s pamphlet called Letter on Corpulence. And Banting was a British undertaker who suffered from what we would now call obesity and you know, accompanying health effects. And he prescribed a low-carbohydrate diet, but he did it in a way that was very compassionate. It wasn't a sort of medical authority top-down, oh, you know, you people down there right. are overeating or you're gluttons or sinners. He said, you know what? I'm an authority, but I'm also someone who suffers from this. You know, little boys taunt me as I walk down the stairway sideways because I can't see my feet. I suffer from this, but I have succeeded. So it's yes. sort of the self-help formula today that I was once in your shoes. I know how you feel. This is how I did it. I'm here to help you. And that was a bestseller in the 1860s. It came stateside. It really set the framework for the early Western diet book. And this is over 150 years ago. So it's a really incredible history.
That's amazing. I mean, Jesus, I'm just laughing going, God, low carb was a hit then too. You know, it's just, it's one of those funny things. Did you see trends? Did you see patterns?
Yes. So this was in the 1860s, but after the Civil War in the United States, there was, you know, more amorphous advice, especially advice that was geared towards beauty. So there was like the one article diet that became popular right before World War One, where, you know, if you want to have a beautiful complexion, you should drink, you know, milk for a creamy complexion. So it sort of segmented out into more feminine diets for beauty or for, you know, composure. And then for more masculine diets, which relied more on scientific nutrition. But then right around the time of World War One, the concept of the calorie was introduced. And this was a revolutionary idea. One very monumental book written by Dr. Lulu Hunt Peters in right during World War One popularized the idea of the calorie. She even included a pronunciation guideline. And in it, she said, well, get rid of your older ideas that some foods are fattening and some foods are not. Rather, think about all your foods in terms of this increment called the calorie. So think of 100 calories of cake or 100 calories of apple. Approach your diet scientifically, and then you can sort of moderate it according to your own body needs. So in her book, which is Diet and Health with Key to the Calories, which was a massive bestseller, she had a diet for weight gain and a diet for weight loss, sort of guiding Americans to achieving a beauty ideal that wasn't necessarily the same thin, fit ideal that we have today. It was more a middle ground. So she said, you can harness science. Even everyday people can harness science and the intimate knowledge of their bodies to moderate their diet to achieve their own personal ideal, be it thinner or heavier.
That's amazing. I know that everyone out there in her podcast land is just transfixed because they've never heard this before. I mean, seriously, I mean, their diet books are either, you know, originating from their mother, right, or even their father. And that's about as far back as it goes. I can remember my mother had Adele Davis. Oh, yeah, she was another one who was out there doing her little registered dietitian thing. But as we went forward, I'm just fascinated with the fact that calories, that very word, suddenly shifted the entire paradigm over to, from something that was, you know, here, have some creamy milk for a creamy complexion, to something where you have metrics. You're now counting, and you're now counting specific calories, and so your attention now is over to these numbers, and somehow these numbers took on, you know, a huge importance, and people were starting to try to wrap their head around what it meant not to be looking at fat, carbohydrate, or protein, but instead how many calories were associated with anything. That's fascinating. So then what was the trend after that?
Yeah, the push to sort of scientific nutrition in the 19-teens and 1920s was really revolutionary. Whether or not that trickled down necessarily to the public at large is up for debate. So sure, you know, there could be federal scientists publishing these sort of newfangled categories of fats, proteins, and carbohydrates in food tables in the 1890s, let's say, or Dr. Lulu Hunt Peters could be publishing this in the 19-teens. But there was still, and I think there may still be, an idea that calories don't necessarily encapsulate the full nutrition of food. Today, they call that nutritionism. And there's, in the alternative food movement, there's a real push against this, rather to embrace whole foods, real foods, foods that induce satiety in a way that maybe surpass their caloric content. So we all know this in your podcast, the listeners know this, that 100 calories of apple induces satiety in a way that like 100 calories of pumpkin pie does not, or even apple pie for that matter. So even though there was this push towards scientific nutrition, there's always been a backlash. We see that backlash in the whole foods movement today. And there was also a backlash in, you know, during the 1920s and 1930s.
Interesting. So there were already always people out there saying, you know, the science is special, thanks for sharing, but at the end of the day, you know, here, have some whole foods and feel satisfied and keep cooking. Well, honestly, if we kind of cheat a little bit now and sort of you know, kind of go forward, here we are in quite the mess, right? So we've got everything going, keto, paleo, Oreos, I don't know. I mean, we have everything going. And at the end of the day, how in the heck can you parse through and make sense of what is now a monumental pile of diet books? People are, you know, there's the individual, you know, diet, customized diet, do-it-yourself diet. It just goes on and on. You know, I know that our Her podcast listeners are sitting there ripping their collective hair out, trying to figure out which way to go. And here you are, you've written a book on diet books. So, you know, what would you say to someone who's now, you know, looking at the ketogenic diet and all the rest of it? What goes on in your mind in terms of sharing some insights and wisdom?
I mean, that's a fantastic million-dollar question. You mentioned keto, paleo, Oreo, and that is in and of itself a trend. I mean, low-carb was the 1860s. The 19-teens was sort of scientific nutrition. We move forward to World War II, and it's a lot of processed foods and people were starting to use some point systems later on in the 60s and 70s. Then, of course, we have Atkins, and a lot of this is old wine and new bottles. Low fat, low carb, low fat, low carb, low fat, low carb. It's this constant dance, but it's also very important to have a historical perspective. So, for example, when keto became a fad, I remember I was talking to a journalist. He said, wow, this keto plan is so new and different because you're doing these urine strip analyses. There's, you know, different apps to measure the carbohydrate content of food. So this is really a step forward from Atkins. I was like, Atkins, Dr. Atkins also prescribed the ketogenic diet in the 1970s, but we lost that historical understanding. In Dr. Atkins' New Diet Revolution, he actually prescribes these urine strips to test for the state of ketosis. Today, that just seems really newfangled and revolutionary because we've lost the historical perspective and because new technologies have enabled the sort of widespread dissemination of this new quantified self-knowledge. So someone who's all gung-ho on keto would do well to remember, okay, well, Atkins also worked for some people in the 1970s and 1980s, but keto isn't somehow going to be vastly different from Atkins. There's still, you know, restricted low-carbohydrate plans that rely on the state of ketosis to induce weight loss. So I think that historical perspective is really valuable because it's seductive to embrace things as new and different when, in fact, they're old and the same. And that kind of historical institutional memory could teach us a lot about what has worked and what hasn't, and what's dangerous and what's safe.
So does paleo fall under the same type of category of old wine, new bottle?
Yes. So the paleo diet has a very interesting history. The first one, you could say, was this Seattle gastroenterologist who was working in the 60s. His name was Walter Wegblin. And his book has been disavowed by the paleo movement today, and for good reason. He was an eccentric, unlikable person with very unpalatable politics. He believed that paleo dieting could lead basically to the master race. He was a eugenicist, which is more like scientific racism, that endorsed paleolithic dieting and paleolithic foods in the same breath that he endorsed the euthanasia of imperfect newborns. So this was a political movement to begin with. And of course, that legacy has, I hope, been entirely erased from the paleo movement today. If you're a paleo dieter, you're obviously not endorsing Wegblin's unpalatable politics. But paleolithic dieting has a history of sort of venerating a natural man. And the idea of who natural man was and how he conducted his life is always a political question. So did natural man kill animals with sort of a bloodthirstiness? Did natural man sort of participate in an order that sort of lifted men up and subdued women, or hunter and gatherers more equal? It's a political question about family structure, about, you know, the idea of a master race. To put it in stark terms, and really these big fundamental ideas about who we are as animals.
So, what is the natural man? You've got us at that now. Okay, how did you handle that in the book? Because, you know, really at the end of the day, there are a lot of presumptions about how, as it were, natural man ate and lived. So the paleo guys said it was one way, and then it turns out it wasn't. You know, they said, oh, there were no grains there. Well, then they found, remnants and fossils of the little mortar bowls where they work the grain, et cetera. At the same time, you know, others said, oh, no, natural man is much more, you know, vegetarian and wasn't like ripping through meat or something. I mean, how did you handle this in the book?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head because it's a question with no answer. I mean, who we are in our sort of essential animal selves or in our state of nature is also a political and moral question. Like, did we live in a state of peace and harmony? That's an answer given by the Eden diet, which is another chapter in the book, that instead of living in caves and engaging in violence, there's another vision of who we are as natural people, which is that actually we lived in the Garden of Eden. We ate largely vegetarian foods, that deliciousness was a sign of God's blessed bounty, that food itself was a blessing from God, and it was not taken lightly by that kind of natural man. And then even within, for example, the paleo movement, there's varying ideas about what truly is human nature. So, for example, there was a book from the 80s that said that men and women lived in a state of natural harmony, that women gathered and men hunted, and each one relied enormously on the nutritional supply of the other. There are other paleo diets that say, well, actually men provided the protein and the women were more there to serve and cook that food. They didn't play as instrumental of a role. So even within the paleo diet, you can see very different visions of what our human nature is and can be. And it's important to remember that that vision translates into the real world today. So if there's a paleo diet that similarly values the foods that could have been gathered, you know, berries or fruits, and the foods that could have been hunted, meats primarily, then there is a sense of sort of equity that you could make the argument travels down through the books today. The Eden diet, for example, also transmits idea of not of aesthetic or self-denial, like many Christian. If you think about Christian diets, you might think, well, this is sort of punishment for gluttony, or this is a sort of repentance for sin. If you actually look at the books, it celebrates an idea of nature that is, you know, blessed and bountiful and delicious, and that men and women could indulge in their natural appetites without shame or without fear of retribution. So there's very different visions of what human nature is and how natural man lived that represent sort of a political question, a moral question, in a way that begs readers, begs dieters to not only evaluate their lifestyle, but also their philosophies. And that's a really important transition. It's like, well, I may just be eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but I'm also evaluating moral ideas about what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be alive? What is my role in the life cycle and the natural order of things? And do I have a right to feel that I can taste deliciousness, that I can embrace my body, that I can celebrate health?
Wow. Okay. I'm blown away. So really what you're saying is many of these diet books reflect cultural assumptions, cultural visions, and many of the trends of the time. So I think a lot of people, for instance, sometimes think that vegans somehow it's almost like a religion, and that they're feeling a bit righteous and above it all because they're the most aesthetic, as it were, kind of everything stripped down. I'm being horribly global about this, but I've heard it enough where I wonder where that's coming from. Vegetarianism is now much more acceptable, where it really went through a lot of ups and downs in the past. Everything from basically being associated with some religions like the Seventh-day Adventists to how you feel politically and culturally about animals and consuming animals and anything that has to do with animals. Although vegetarianism is much more fluid and flexible. So then I'm thinking of all these other things you're thinking of, like I'm just sort of reframing in my mind based upon what you said. Who really does embrace a lot of the keto stuff? Is it hardcore athletes, looking for that body? Is it, people who are super achievers who want to be on the bleeding edge of whatever kind of dietary trends are out there? Really, what is it? Does that make sense to you?
Yes, I hear two really important questions, both about the role of religion, especially in the rise of vegetarianism and veganism, and then also the identity of who these dieters are. I mean, the dieter that follows a vegan plan may have a very different worldview, philosophy, politics than the dieter that follows the ketogenic plan. First, if you look at the sort of history and cultural heft of vegetarianism, it is often rooted in religion. You mentioned the Seventh-day Adventist, the most famous Seventh-day Adventist who reshaped American cuisine is Dr. John Harvey Kellogg. You know, we have him to thank for cornflakes. And the reason why cornflakes were invented in the first place is because Dr. Kellogg believed, and many of his followers, very high-profile followers, believed that meat and spices stimulated the appetite, sexual and in terms of hunger, and that a bland vegetarian diet was an antidote for our sort of essential animal, brutish nature. So his beliefs translated into different cuisines that we still embrace today. So unlike the very meat-heavy British diet, after Kellogg and his brother came along, we started to have more vegetarian breakfast, lighter vegetarian breakfast. And the religious tones do travel down today. I mean, you're right. Vegans are sometimes painted as self-righteous or holier than thou. And combined with the traditions of intermittent fasting, which is so popular today, it also picks up on the spiritual or religious undertones. That may be an unfair accusation, but it's one that picks up in a very sensitive way to the legacy of sort of religion and spirituality in promoting these diets. We probably can all think of the Jains, for example, of India, who, you know, are such fervent and sincere believers in the sanctity of human life that sometimes they don't even eat root vegetables because it can injure the, you know, the insects and that grow also in the ground. Then think of the Judeo-Christian traditions that embrace fasting for certain religious reasons, or the laws of kashrut or halal that also endorse dietary restrictions as a way to either bring the person closer to God or create, you know, in-group identity, or somehow moderate the diet in a, to mold the believer into a closer relationship, not only to their religion, but also to their own body and spirit.
Well, you mentioned the F word, so we're going to have to go there immediately.
Oh.
All right, because everyone out there in her podcast land is on some kind of wild-ass diet that involves fasting. Okay. Now,
yes.
You know, the overarching term is intermittent fasting. And, mm-hmm. You know, clearly it's certainly taken on. And quite frankly, there's some very strong research evidence that specific kinds of a fasting protocol are actually exquisitely efficacious. So, mm-hmm. For instance, I'll give you an example. Dr. Sachin Panda had made famous, and he's at the Salk Institute in San Diego, his work with time-restricted feeding. Basically, what he was mm-hmm. saying was, let's get natural. Let's do the natural thing, and that's called living by the circadian rhythm. So we got 24 hours in the day. In America and in civilized, and I quote, societies out there, in those 24 hours, how can we completely screw up our biorhythms? I mean, seriously, we're eating 24/7, we're up 24/7, we're just not getting enough sleep, we're eating stupid stuff. It just goes on and on. There's no routine, there's no anything to it. All right. However, if you look at something like time-restricted feeding, which could be at its very simplest, something your mother told you, and that is you eat during 12 hours and you don't eat during the other 12. So that's a 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. proposition, which, of course, is exquisitely acceptable. I mean, who's going to call that draconian? And you could actually take those 12 hours of non-feeding up to 16 hours so that you're on a 16-8 protocol. I mean, there's a lot of wiggle room there. So you have a huge amount of science there. So to your point about science dictating so much of this, I think today, because we have so much great new technology and ways to be able to reframe things, I mean, let's put it this way, the Nobel Prize was given to three American scientists in New York, who discovered the circadian rhythm genes in the brain. And so everything's circadian rhythm now. It's like, okay, 24 hours. And what's the best thing to do during that time with lots of science behind it? So there's one form of, as it were, you know, when you say the word fasting, you have to define it. So the way I like to call it instead, in many respects, is just simply you're feeding or you're non-feeding. You know, the word fasting, again, let's hear from you on this one. Fasting in our society means something very different than in Germany or in Europe per se, where they've had all kinds of interesting spas and places where you go where you just don't eat. You, and I quote, cleanse and whatever. If you try to now fly that over here on a United Airlines flight to the USA, fasting sounds religious, but it also may sound medical. You know, you have to fast before that colonoscopy. Or it could sound kind of like a downer, like who the heck would want to fast when you have food on every corner, you know, in the city? So now I'll shut up, and now you can comment on the fasting phenomenon.
I definitely agree with that. Like, the idea of fasting has such cultural and religious baggage. It sounds religious. It sounds medical. It sounds ascetic. It sounds like it's just seeped in self-denial. But if you look at the nuts and bolts of American culinary history, what we had was breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Well, the food industry is very invested in having us eat more and eat more often. And that, I think, is what a lot of nutritionists and public health experts have pointed to as one of the reasons of the rise of the obesity epidemic, which is this constant snacking. That, and Dr. Marion Nestle has pointed this out with a lot of good research and also eloquence, that it's now acceptable to eat in bookstores or in the library, and you buy food from gas stations. The idea that you're constantly eating, you're constantly consuming calories, is a great business model for food companies that are trying to increase their, you know, to always grow their businesses. And also, it can be very damaging to public health, because without the, you know, solid three squares a day, the ritual of it, the social norms of it, when you break down the social norms of when and where and how it is appropriate to eat, you could argue that it's freeing because it's allowing people to choose their own method of eating that might best suit them as individuals. But you also could argue that this is a breakdown of social norms that were instituted for a reason, to moderate the appetites of the table, to create a social and cultural ritual. Dr. Nestle has made the argument that if you just take away snacks and soda, you can basically account for the entire obesity epidemic. That the constant snacking, the social norms of snacking, have given us the calories, the excess calories that now account for the obesity epidemic. So your term, Dr. Peak, of feeding and non-feeding is really helpful, because you're not fasting between 9 and 12, between, you know, breakfast and lunch. You're just not eating. So as long as you're not eating food you get from the gas station, you're not eating at your desk, I would call that just not eating, not fasting, which has so much cultural and religious and social baggage.
That's exactly correct. And that's why I use it. Because to me, it made no sense whatsoever to use the word fasting. You're not fasting. Quite frankly, between you and me, what we have found in clinical research is that, you know, to be able to begin to benefit from a lot of the metabolic effects of fasting, especially if you're someone who's diabetic, et cetera, you need 48 hours before it really kicks in. 48 hours. Hmm. And that's also the time it takes to use up the stored glucose in your body. It's called glycogen in your liver and other places, so that now you kick into a nice self-cleansing part of the metabolic paradigm, which is called autophagy or autophagy, self-eating. We just get rid of all that excess garbage, and then out the other end it goes. So the word fast, I think, is rather fascinating to me, the way it's been bandied around. You really do feel almost like you're a spiritual hero. If you say, oh, I fasted yesterday. Oh, my gosh, you did? You know, it's like, really? Seriously? I just find this whole thing really, really interesting. And I think science is going to take us to some, well, you know what it is? If anything, one of the things this whole intermittent fasting type of overlay is doing is it's rebelling against the three squares. Because truth be told, who said we needed three squares a day? Now, I'm playing with you here. Who said that? Okay, I'm going to flash back to a cave woman, right? Really? She had three squares? Come on. She was happy to score once a day if she was lucky. You know, a nice, wonderful meal somehow that, I don't know, somebody cobbled together back then. But to say, oh my gosh, it's time for a breakfast. Really? You got out of that cave or wherever the heck you were, and you started foraging and hunting and I don't know, whatever you were doing out there just to score some food. The three squares was part of that whole Kellogg play. You know, there are a lot of assumptions that go along with this. Do we really truly need three meals a day? Ooh, the intermittent fasting, you know, folk are basically breaking that rule into 600,000 pieces. And quite frankly, if you're doing a time-restricted feeding at 16:8, you only need two meals because you're only eating during an 8-hour window. And if you're eating during a 10-hour window, it's a little questionable. And then once you obviously get to 11 and 12, you're getting closer to kind of spreading it out a bit more. But what's healthier, right? What goes on? And experts are debating this big time right now because the food companies would have you believe one thing potentially, because to your point, of course they want you eating all day, starting the first thing in the morning. Who said you needed to do that? That first meal was called a break fast. So, you know, they use the term loosely that you were obviously maybe you finished eating around 6 p.m. or whatever, and you went to bed or eventually, but you weren't eating in the evening. You woke up in the morning. It was at least 12 hours later. So you were, in their eyes, kind of fasting, really non-feeding. And then that first meal was going to be a break fast at whatever time it took place, whether it was noon or 9 a.m. So I just find this all fascinating. Where do you think this is all going to take us here? You know, let's look into your crystal ball.
I mean, there's two levels. I feel like the three squares model has already been phased out. What I think intermittent fasting is doing and doing well is that it's saying, well, actually, maybe the three squares was more effective because right now, I mean, we have, what, 10 little squares? If we're constantly snacking, the three squares itself would be an improvement because it still segments time out to, as in your terms, non-feed. It also goes a step further and says, well, maybe there are some days that you don't need to eat at all, or there are some time blocks in your day that you don't need to eat either. But what's important here is that it's moderating the timing of food so that there are some periods, you know, short or long, that eating is not acceptable. And I think that harkens back to an older, you know, maybe even Kellogg's story here, in which you have a meal, a meal, a meal, and it's sort of, you don't snack throughout the day. And that is largely a story of industrialization and modernization and the rise of processed food industry. And the idea of three squares, as you gestured towards, also mimics the sort of industrial workday. So if you're going to a factory, you know, that lunch bell rings at 12 o'clock. You have 45 minutes to go to the, you know, boiled egg cart outside and eat. No longer is it dictated by either your own natural cycles of hunger and satiety or the rise and fall of the sun. That's a little bit essentializing and hand-waving, but I will point out that the structure of three squares is also a modern invention that mimics the pattern of the sort of general workday.
You're absolutely correct. Absolutely. And that's incredibly important. And people like Kellogg and others fed into that with their products. No question about it.
Mm-hmm. And it was very much in the best interest of, a variety of businesses, employers included, that they have their employees on a rigid schedule that, once that lunch bell rings, they're going to have easy access to quick and cheap food to just sort of supply the workers with a short burst of energy to get them through from 1 to 5 p.m. That may not work for everyone, and it is sort of an artifice of that particular structure of labor systems that may have lived out its usefulness in the modern culture. Because we have access to food all the time, it's liable to sort of devolve into this constant snacking. And also our work patterns are not as regimented as, working in cotton factories or, working even as accountants in the 1920s and 1930s. We're working at our desks, we have flexibility, there's a lot more remote workers, there's a lot more ways that we can moderate our own feeding schedule that isn't dictated by the needs of the workforce, the needs of the employers. So maybe that in and of itself is a modern artifice that has lived out its usefulness in today's labor market.
I just think this, seriously, I could threaten you with, staying on the line with you forever and continue this interview. This has just been fabulous. I want to read toward the end of your book, because I love the way you put this together as we close. It's difficult to grow tired of diet books. There's a lullaby in the sameness of the story. The diet books repeat themselves, mourning the same fallen world, promising the same future, berating the same people for the same reasons, for being fat and ugly, for reneging on their promises, for being sick and sad and stressed. Paleo diets mourn our buried caveman past. Devotional diets remember God's grace. Primitive diets lament a paradise corrupted by colonialism. Detoxification diets grieve for a virgin land now sullied by industry. Diet books may repeat themselves, but strength is to be had from steadfast insistence. We should think of diet books as a bugle, a Bansby, something that calls out and insists Americans pay attention to a story, our story, that we are all writing with every single meal. Whoa, loving it. Everyone, we have been talking to Dr. Adrienne Bitar. That's B as in boy, I-T-A-R. She is the author of just a ridiculously fascinating book. It's called Diet and the Disease of Civilization. Please, please, please grab this book. I just love it. Gonna love it. Her Twitter handle is Adrienne. That's A-D-R-I-E-N-N-E-B-I-T-A-R. And oh my gosh, you better keep doing your research, Adrienne, because I'm just saying, this is amazing work. Let's keep it rocking. Adrienne, thank you so much for being on the Her Podcast.
Oh, thank you. This has been a true pleasure.
All right. And listen, everyone out there, run right now. That's right. Hear all those little high heels running. And hit iTunes and rate and review the show, because this was awesome. To say the least, you learned a heck of a lot. Well, listen, I'm going to be waiting to hear from you. Love your feedback. Why? Because I'm Dr. Pam Peek, the host of the Her Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode on the Her Podcast, on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today. And for Pete's sake, stay well.